A while ago, I was in Australia. And we were working with the Aborigines in the outback, and on the way, we stopped off in the bush for like a bush camp for a week. And the bush is really, as it's described, it's basically bushes. Everywhere outback, there's pretty much nothing. But there was a river nearby. And one really, really hot day, we decided to make what we called lilos. They weren't really lilos, they were kind of makeshift rafts, and go down this river. It was a little bit like this. Here's a picture coming up. And this is in the bush in Australia. And we just thought, what a great day out this is going to be. So there's about 12 of us in this river, going down these little rapid sections on these makeshift rafts. And we're having a great time. And after a while, we started to get a little bit tired. And there was three of us on my raft. And we thought we'd explore a little bit further down the river. And we went further down. And then we decided we probably needed to paddle back up the river, because we didn't really want to trek through the bush, because they tell you all these stories in Australia of snakes and spiders, don't they? So you know, we wanted to go in the water where we were safe, because you reckon you can see crocodiles quicker than you can see snakes. And we were paddling up this river, and we got really quite tired, and we weren't making any progress. And you know that kind of split-second moment on a day like that, where you go from having a wonderful time to, oh, this is a little bit scary. We're not moving. Another half an hour of trying to get back up to where we were, and we weren't moving. And we were pretty tired at this stage. And it was getting late, and the rest of the group were further up the river. So we made a tactical decision that we would just sit on our raft and cruise down the river, because we reckon there must be a place that the road that we came on crossed the river at some point. You do make silly decisions when you're in your 20s. And off we went down this river, just lying there, no longer fighting the river. I went on and on, and it started to get dark. And on it went, till it was dark. And eventually we found this road, and we knew that if we followed the road, we'd get back to camp. We got back to camp at about 5:30 in the morning. The camp leaders had called the police, as you can imagine, but it's the bush. So, I mean, how are they going to find you out there? The whole camp had been praying. They thought we were dead because we'd been gone such a long time. Now, the reason I tell you that story is it's a good illustration of what's going on in the church that this letter has been written to. They have given up paddling upstream. They've just given up. And they started to drift with the current. What we didn't know when we were drifting is that if we'd have gone another mile, there was a waterfall. The police told us that when we got back to camp. And I think, gosh, we'd never have seen that. We'd have never realised that was coming. And the journey of this church that being written to is one of, well, danger. Because they're drifting. So on the opposite of drifting, you've got this call to perseverance. They're drifting, and the Hebrew writer is saying, persevere, don't give up. Beginning of chapter 2, it says this: we must pay the most careful attention, therefore, to what we've heard, so that we do not drift away. As you go from chapter 2 through to chapter 10, here are some of the themes that you see are happening to the people, the Christians. Well, firstly, they're drifting. They're not rowing against the current of sin. They're just kind of drifting backwards. They're not paying much attention to what it means to be a Christian in the real world. They're kind of just drifting along and they're neglecting it. Their conversation evidently is more about the world and the issues they've got and what clubs they've got to get the kids to, or the problems at the office, or what's in the news, than what Christ has for them and who he is and what he has done for them. And their sin is starting to deceive them. They're neglecting God's guidelines, and it's causing them to drift and slip and lose their hold on their joyful confidence. And you know what? That's terribly dangerous. They have then lost urgency. They become so negligent and careless that their spiritual walk and their godly fear is pretty much evaporated. They're just drifting along with the music of the world in their ears, enjoying the tune. While God's messenger in Hebrews cries out to them and says, look, be careful, Niagara Falls is coming. Be careful, judgment is approaching. But they're not careful. What we see in chapters 2 to 10 is that they are careless rather than careful. The Bible has become uninteresting to them. Their desire for teaching and preaching of God's word has faded. Their energy to think and ask questions about the most important questions in life and the world has seeped away. And in its place has come this kind of spiritual sluggishness, a kind of insensitivity to God. And the audacity they have is that they blame him for that. So they're kind of drifting along, drifting down this river. And you might think, well, so what? Look at the end of the section. Chapter 10, verse 39. It gives us a hint of why the so what is so important. But we are not of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but of those who have faith and keep their souls. There's a strict and sudden warning in Hebrews of the danger of the drift. It can lead to destruction. That is why this whole letter is written to believers to not get complacent. Oh, do you know what? I'm just going to set my sights at being a middle-of-the-road Christian and drift along and just do enough but not too much. That lot are slightly too passionate for me. I'm just going to do my bit, tick the boxes, and that's enough. But the Hebrew writer says, no, you're going to drift. You're going to compromise. You're going to become sluggish. And ultimately, it leads to destruction. It's quite a severe warning, isn't it? It's there to make us sit up and listen. And it's there to lift our eyes, not in fear, but in wonder of what we have in Jesus. Because the opposite of drift is perseverance. Now imagine we're out in the town of Brackley and there's a Brackley marathon going on. There is no such thing as a Brackley marathon, is it? It's far too far for us lot out here. But imagine there was, and we were supporting somebody in the church who was running a marathon. Now, you wouldn't shout from the sidelines, persevere. I mean, it's a bit odd, isn't it, in our culture to shout persevere at somebody running a race. But you would shout, keep going. Hang on in there. Don't give up. And that is the resounding theme that comes up time and time and time again. So if you hear anything today, hear that. Don't give up. Keep going. Hang on in there. So you've got two choices. One is to press on towards maturity in knowledge and faith and hope and holiness. And the other is to drift slowly into indifference and dullness and eventually destruction. And the point of this book is to press on, to hold on. And the way that the writer helps us do that is marvellous. You'd expect, wouldn't you, if you had a whole church of people that is drifting, that you'd be shouting at them, for goodness sake, wake up. For goodness sake, paddle harder. But look at how he starts. He lifts our eyes in the most incredible way. He lifts our eyes to Jesus. You're lying on that raft. Christian life is hard. You're tempted to drift. And rather than say, you're numpty, you're useless, oh, for goodness sake, paddle harder, the writer goes, look at Jesus. Look at him. And when you look at him and you see him clearly, you'll be inspired to keep going. And that's exactly what we're going to do. So let's dive in to chapter 1 as we begin this series together. There's no introduction. There's no definitive answer to who wrote Hebrews. It's part of the canon of scripture. And here we have an incredible start. In the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets. That's the Old Testament. And many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son. When it says last days, the last days the Bible is referring to is the day from Jesus' resurrection to Jesus' return. Those are the last days. We don't know how long they're going to be, but we're living in them. So when you hear that here, it refers to now. It refers to us. And he has spoken to us by his Son, who he has appointed heir of all things, and through whom also he made the universe. That's a little sideline, isn't it? Through this man, Jesus Christ, he made the universe. And then verse 3, the Son is the radiance of God's glory, the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. That is who Jesus is, right from the outset. Do you see what he wants us to see? He wants us to see who Jesus is. He's not some human philosopher. He's not some great human example of what life should be like. He is the exact representation of God. He is God himself, as you'll see later on in this passage. He is the very radiance of God's glory. So take a good, deep look at him. Christ has sat down at the right hand of the Father. Look, it goes on to say, after he had provided purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty in heaven. So he became as much superior to angels as the name he's inherited is superior to theirs. Jesus is sat down at the right hand. That is the position of authority, supreme authority. He didn't die, rise again, and go away, and is slightly absent from the world that he created. No, he is sat at the right hand in the place of supreme authority over all things. He is there, and he's in control. But then you've got verse 4. And you go, what? So he became as much superior to angels as the name he has inherited is superior to theirs. Angels is not something we really ever talk about, is it? It's not a common form of language in Christian circles, let alone in society. If you were to sit there with a bunch of mates at a pub on a Friday night and say, shall we have a chat about angels? They go, what are you talking about? There's that book, Angels and Demons, isn't there? And there's lots of movies where angels are represented, but they're not real, are they? They're not there, are they? And the Bible talks a lot about angels. A lot. Over 300 times. Over 300 times. And yet, if you were to take the average Christian, British Christian, and you were to ask them, so explain to me what angels are, they go, Google it. Probably would be their answer. And they wouldn't know what to Google if they were Googling it. So let's have a go. Let's see what we learn as we go through this passage. The first thing that the writer wants us to get is this. Jesus is better than angels. Not better at running or better at things like calligraphy or anything like that. He is just superior. Now, perhaps going on in the church there was a belief that Jesus was just merely an angel or a human being. And you go, oh, okay, well, that doesn't exist today. Yes, it does. Go and talk to Jehovah's Witness. They'll tell you that Jesus is just an archangel. Yeah. Or go and read the Quran or talk to a Hindu. And you'll see how they view Jesus not as the Son of God. So many people today who are not Christians would say that Jesus is, well, he was a human philosopher, perhaps at best, a historical figure if you're a secular mindset. If you come from a Muslim background, you'd probably say he is one of God's prophets. If you come from a JW background, they'd say, oh, he is an archangel. But right from the outset, Hebrews says, no, he is much superior to angels. Somehow, thinking about angels had gotten out of hand in the churches that this is being written to. We can tell this by how much the writer gives to setting things straight. He spends the rest of this chapter and going into chapter 2, and he deals with this issue around angels. I wonder if we think straight about it. I wonder if you realise that if you do think straight about it, it'll lift your eyes to Jesus. It'll encourage your heart and build your faith. It's not an added extra that the super charismatic weirdos would think about. It is biblical to think about it. Don't be afraid, but engage with what he says. Hopefully this is going to prove really relevant as we continue to live out and are diligent as we fight the drift of indifference. So Jesus is better, verse 4. He is much superior to angels, as the name he has inherited is superior to theirs. And in verse 4, it kind of answers how he is better as it continues into verse 5. Look what it says. For to which of the angels did God ever say, "You are my son, today I have become your father"? Here in Hebrews chapter 1, he quotes multiple passages of the Old Testament of how God addresses Jesus. He's saying, look, he is not an angel. He is superior to angels. Notice he's not saying angels don't exist. I will come on to that towards the end of the chapter. But he's saying Jesus is superior to angels. He is the king. Or again, I'll be his father and he'll be my son. And again, when God brings his firstborn into the world, he says, let all God's angels worship him. So Jesus is God's son. He is not an angel. He is not the pinnacle of angels, but he is the very representation of God himself. And here, the angels, they worship him, not the other way around. It doesn't go stones, elephants, humans, Jesus, angels, God. Okay? It goes stones, elephants, humans, but nothing against stones. Study geology, but they're anatomy, aren't they? Stones, elephants, humans, angels, and their multiple ranks. The Bible has many ranks of angels. Jesus. He is God himself. And he's the Son in a new way. He is the Son who created the universe, and he is the Son through his death and resurrection who has redeemed the universe. And he's the Son who will return to restore the universe. That is who he is. And we are to see that in every way and in every time he is superior to all things. And him, look back at verse 3, we have purification for sins. We are made right before God. So Jesus is better, and the angels know that Jesus is better because they are to worship him. Angels are to worship Jesus. And you see, worship is a big issue, isn't it? All other world religions view Jesus as some religious figure, historical figure, a prophet, many of them. But what they refuse to do is worship him as God. He never claimed to be a moral teacher. He claimed to be the way to the Father, the only way. He claimed to be God himself and proved it through his resurrection. And therefore, the only response to him that's worthy is worship. And that is exactly what angels do. They worship the Son. As you see here, not only is Jesus better than angels, but angels worship God, but Jesus is God. God calls him God. It's a funny statement, isn't it? God calls him God. But about the Son, verse 8, he says, your throne, O God, will last forever and ever. He's not some subset of God or some human invented ruler, but God himself, Jesus. I was once doing a lunch bar, which is like a lunchtime talk in a Bath university a while ago, and the head of the Islamic Society came. There was a Q&A at the end, and he said, "Oh, well, Jesus never claimed to be God." I was like, "Really? Have you read the Bible?" He said, "Oh, yeah, he never really claimed to be God, you know." And he goes, "Well, let me show you." And he had been taught that Jesus never claimed to be God, but as we journeyed through the Bible and we looked at it together over a coffee, he said, "Wow, actually, the whole thing points to the fact that he is God. He's not just a prophet that teaches how to live. He is God himself who loves his people." So Jesus is better than angels. Jesus is God. And what I want you to do is I want you to test yourself. Okay, so let's do a little heart MOT before we continue. Here's the heart MOT. Are you drifting? Are you drifting in your faith in Jesus? Do you love Jesus as God? Does Jesus hold a place in your life worthy of God himself? We often say that we exist for him. We live for him. Would that be evident in your last week's activities, in your conversation, in your times on your own? Are you drifting? If you are, look at him. And if you're not, keep looking at him. Because Jesus is the only one who saves. He is the only one who gives life to the universe. He's the only one who is God himself. So often, people say, "Oh, my Christian life has become dull. I feel like I'm treading water. I feel like I'm not moving forward in my relationship with God." And often that's because they've lost sight of Jesus. They've not taken the time to remember who he is. We think we know who he is, but when we read chapters like this, we see who he is. And as we see who he is, it thrills our heart and lifts our eyes. And we begin to realize that everything is shaped by him. Everything is for him. Everything is under his control. There's not a moment of your life that's insignificant because it's given by him and is for him. Your life is not your own. He gave it to you. He could end it like that. He sustains you now and he has a purpose. Not for your glory, but for his as he works it through you. That purpose may include suffering. That's okay. He keeps you through it. That purpose may not be clear. That's okay, because he knows what he's doing. That purpose may be daunting. That's okay. He's right there with you, right to the very end. The Christian life cannot be dull, because it's a life lived with Jesus at the centre, the one who made all things. And you can trust him with your life, with your possessions, with your hopes, with your dreams. And as you do, as you put it all on the table, he is not lacking in his ability to deliver and lead you into a life worth living. So the first part of this passage is clear in helping us see that Jesus is superior above all things. And it continues. Verse 10, he also says, "In the beginning, Lord, you laid the foundations of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you remain. They will all wear out like a garment. You will roll them up like a robe." That's power, isn't it? To roll up the universe like a robe. "Like a garment, they will be changed, but you remain the same, and your years will never end." It's an incredible statement about a person who is God. A little while after being in the river in Australia, I walked back into another river with Alice. She hated it. We were in Uganda and we went whitewater rafting. Don't ask her about it. She doesn't really want to talk about it. It was wonderful fun, depending which member of the family you talk about, or talk to about it. And we took a whole bunch of students with us, white water rafting, and the guide said, can you swim? So I asked the group, can you swim? I said, well, can you just clarify what you mean by swim? He said, can you swim a length of a pool? So I asked the group, they all said yes. Turns out they were lying. One of them, whose name is Aidan, when he fell in at the first rapid section, remember Phoebe's Run? You know, you remember Phoebe's Run on Friends? That's how he swam. And so he fell out, and I'm watching him thinking, is he joking? Is he? I mean, thank the Lord he was wearing a life jacket, because there was no way that was going to sustain him above the water. Absolute panic, kind of windmill actions, upright. To the point where if it hadn't been pretty scary, it would have been quite funny. And as we're going down these rapid sections, we got chucked out all the time. It was 12 massive rapid sections. It was 5 hours long. And we got chucked out of the boat most of the rapid sections. We had one broken arm, one concussion. Alice had to go off to hospital halfway through the rapid sections to take some of the students to hospital. And it was amazing, depending on which perspective you're looking at it from. And one of the absolute joys, looking back on it, is that we weren't on our own. As we were going down the river in our rafts, we had a guide. They were useless. They just flipped the boats the whole time. But as you were going down, you had guys like this in the front in canoes. So it didn't matter if you swam like Phoebe, because they pulled you out. They were there to serve us all the way down. For 5 hours, they pulled us out of the river and put us back in the inflatable. For 5 hours, and there was a lot of us, they must have been exhausted by the end of it. But without them, I don't think any of us would have made it. Or we'd have gone down a whole river, the source of the Nile, on our backs rather than in boats. When we come to the very end of Hebrews chapter 1, there's a statement there that most Christians will gloss over. It says, to which of the angels did God ever say, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet? Are not all angels ministering spirits sent to serve those who inherit salvation? Are not all angels ministering spirits sent to serve those who inherit salvation? Temptation is to gloss over that verse, because the point of the passage is that Jesus is better than angels. He's superior. Keep your eyes fixed on him. But what he's also showing us is that angels have a purpose. They're created by God for a purpose. In fact, hundreds of times throughout the Bible, it talks about angels. Jesus has supreme authority. They are sent as servants. There's only one king, that's Jesus, but there are many servant angels. They are servants of Christians. Do you see that? Sent to serve those who inherit salvation. And Christ is the king over the church. Angels do his bidding for the church. So throughout your life as a believer, there's been angels working on your behalf. Chew on that for a moment. How do they serve us? Well, the connection between verses 13 and 14 give us a clue. It says that while Christ is seated on the throne, something is happening to bring his enemies under his feet like a footstool. Do you see that? Until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. What is happening? Well, one of those things is that the angels are being sent to serve those who inherit salvation. In other words, there are enemies of salvation. We often talk about them as the unholy trinity, don't we, as a church? The world, the flesh, and the devil. And there are enemies of salvation trying to cause drift, not save people from drift. And God sends his angels to serve believers. Like the canoeist helping as we fill out the boat, they are there to serve believers. To serve so that we persevere. Serve So the enemies of God will be made into a footstool for him. One of the dangers is that we speculate about angels. We conjure up ideas and ways we think they are working and what they are doing. That is dangerous. You can create all kinds of random and weird theologies about angels. It does mention angels 300 times. Let me give you some of the key examples so that you can have a robust understanding of what they are and what they do. Angels announced the birth of Jesus to Mary in Luke chapter 1, to Zechariah and Elizabeth in Luke chapter 1, to Joseph in Matthew chapter 1, and to the shepherds in Luke chapter 2. They ministered to Jesus in the wilderness in Mark chapter 1. They rolled away the stone from Jesus' tomb in Matthew 28. They opened the prison doors to the apostles in Acts chapter 5. They directed the evangelist where to go, like Philip, in Acts chapter 8. They spoke to unbelievers like Cornelius about what they should do to find the gospel in Acts chapter 10. They will come with Jesus, the Bible says, at his second coming in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1. And that's just a sample of the activity in the Bible, particularly in the New Testament, of what the angels are doing and continue to do. They're mentioned over 100 times in the Old Testament. And there's really four key biblical ways that angels serve believers. The first is this: they serve them in salvation. They help them to see Jesus. That little nudge when the Christian friend phones you when you're really struggling. And we think, oh, well done, Christian friend, pat on the back, you're a glorious Christian. Who gave them the nudge? The Spirit of God through his angels. That little moment where you thought all was lost for your Christian friend, and then you suddenly get a phone call saying, oh, no, I'm back going to church. And you go, wow, that's amazing. And yet we see just the physical rather than what's going on behind the scenes. They serve us to inherit salvation. In the Psalms, we see they execute God's will. In the Bible, inanimate objects do his will. He commands the sea and it obeys him, doesn't it? Animals do his will. He commands a whale and it swallows Jonah. Humans do his will and angels do his will. When God decided to create, he thought it wise to create hierarchies of beings, from the stone to the worm to the whale to the human, and then to the multiple ranks of angels. Some are called archangels. He created ranks of angels, and when they become demonic, when they reject him, there are ranks of principalities and powers in the heavenly realms who are anti-God. We see that in Ephesians chapter 6. Angels execute God's will on earth, and they magnify the grandeur of God. They point to the wonder and the glory of God, because what we do is we shrink him and put him in our pockets. God becomes a little thing in our lives, and they go, no. He is more powerful than you can imagine, more mighty than you can dream, more significant than you can understand. He created millions upon millions of angels as a fitting royal assembly for his magnificence. Last week, we understood that a little bit clearer, didn't we? There was all those fellas in Busby's. A weird and wonderful British thing that makes absolutely no sense, does it? I mean, who would go to war in a Busby? It's just odd. Yet, the processions last weekend were incredible. This assembly that escorts the Queen and royalty. God's escort is way more impressive. They're angels, millions and millions of them, and they point to his grandeur. There's a vast crowd of colossal beings all assembled before one great King, Jesus. It speaks, doesn't it, to us in a unique way about the glory and the imperial majesty of the King of Kings. It also helps us feel rightly small. So often we get an over-realised sense of self, don't we? Of our importance, Thank the Lord that I was born. Thank the Lord that I was born today. Gosh, if it didn't have me in this generation, what on earth would happen? As we see God, through his Son, in his grandeur, surrounded by millions of angels way more powerful than us, it has the same impact, magnified by a million, that the procession of the Jubilee has. You see the glory and the wonder of the King. And angels, not only do they magnify the grandeur of God, but they call attention to the worth of every believer. We see that in Matthew 18. Look what it says here. Jesus says, "See that you do not despise one of these little ones," or one of my believers. He's referring to us. "For because here's the reason you must not despise any Christians, by the way. Because I tell you that in heaven, their angels," that's plural, there's not one angel for one person, "always see the face of my Father." Another verse that we kind of gloss over. So don't despise the annoying, unimpressive disciple of Jesus that really irritates you. Why? Well, their angels see the face of the Father. They have inherited salvation through the Son. And their angels work on their behalf for Jesus' glory. Isn't that amazing? So put your hand over your critical mouth. Show great esteem for the ordinary, unimpressive Christian. Because there's angels working on their behalf for the glory of the King. And not just for them, but for you too. God knows you and he loves you. He sent the King of Kings, who created all things, to die for you. He rose from the dead and is preparing a place for you in heaven that will never spoil or fade. And right now, through beings that we can only begin to understand, that are beyond our science and our understanding and comprehension, called angels, he is working consistently and continually on your behalf to bring you to himself. You may never see them intervene, but they are. You may never feel their presence, but they're there. You may never acknowledge their existence, but they're as real as you are right now, working on behalf of the King. So angels are real. They're sent into the world for the sake of Christians. You know, you might entertain an angel without knowing it. It talks about that, doesn't it? But they're not to become our focus. We're not to go around angel spotting. "Oh, that one looks like an angel. He's definitely a demon." You know, that's not what we're supposed to be doing. Because the angel's role is to point you to the Son. So we are to fix our eyes on Jesus. We are to persevere to the very end, knowing that we're not on our own. The Spirit of God is in us. The angels are ministering on our behalf, and the Son awaits us. As we see later on, in Hebrews, he stands on our behalf before the Father. So if you begin to drift this week, lift your eyes. Remember, Jesus is better than anything else in the world that has to offer. That he is working on your behalf through beings more colossal, more powerful than you can even imagine. Every day, all night, to bring you to him. Because he wants you there. He has done everything on your behalf. Our role, same as the angels, to worship him, to give him everything, all of the time. There is nothing more important in your existence, in your day, than to worship him with all that you are, all of the time. Nothing else will add more to your life. Nothing else will be as valuable. Worship him with all of you are, all of the time. So there we go. The marathon has begun. The call is to persevere. The helpers are there beside us, and the King awaits us. That is the beginning of our journey into this incredible book. And hopefully you'll stick with us throughout this journey and really grasp the wonder of what it means to live by faith in the Son. Let me finish with the words later on in this incredible, incredible book. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith.